From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today is May Day, International Workers' Day. Hundreds of thousands gather around the world to march for workers' rights. We'll go to Paris. Hundreds of thousands are marching against the far-right presidential candidate Jean-Marie Le Pen, to London, to Washington.
It's great that it's made, that it's a public holiday in South Africa, but not yet in the United States.
We'll speak with Father Michael Lapsley. He was blown up in apartheid South Africa by a letter bomb from the apartheid regime. He'll talk about apartheid, occupation, and reconciliation. And Maud Barlow, part two of our conversation on blue gold, the fight to stop the corporate theft of the world's water.
Everyone agrees who's looking at this. The United Nations, the World Bank, the World Watch Institute, everyone says that by the year 2025, almost two-thirds of the world's population will be living without access to clean water.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has recommended to the UN Security Council that the UN team investigating the Israeli military assault on the Jenin refugee camp be sent home. This after Israel's continued refusal to let it start work. The Times of London reports Annan appears to have lost a major test of strength with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, but it's more accurate to say Annan lost to Sharon and the Bush administration. It has now been confirmed that President Bush and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice promised to support Israel in blocking the UN inquiry into Jenin in return for releasing Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat from the Israeli army siege of his compound in Ramallah. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, sources in Sharon's office say that Rice and Sharon's foreign policy advisor had been in, quote, constant connection during Sunday's stormy all-day session of the Israeli cabinet, many of whose members oppose giving Arafat freedom of movement. Sharon told the cabinet one point, quote, "We have to do this because Bush has offered help with the Jenin fact-finding team affair." Sharon won them over on a 17-9 vote. To sweeten the pot, Condoleezza Rice also delivered an invitation from Bush to Sharon asking the Israeli leader to visit Washington next week. Meanwhile, talks to end Israel's siege of Arafat are due to resume after hitting a snag overnight when Israeli troops blocked Palestinian officials from traveling to Arafat's besieged compound to get a final go-ahead for a deal. British and U.S. consuls are scheduled to meet Arafat today to iron out a plan to transfer six wanted Palestinians trapped in Arafat's compound to a prison in Jericho, where they'll be guarded by British and U.S. warders. Israeli forces in the southern Gaza Strip killed four Palestinians, including a two-year-old girl. Israel allowed 26 Palestinians to leave the besieged Church of the Nativity. UN aid agencies say Israeli troops are preventing the delivery of food to tens of thousands of Palestinians in desperate need of help following the Israeli invasion. Senior Israeli army sources are admitting that troops engaged in systematic vandalism and looting during the invasion, destroying computers, keyboards, even entire bank branches. One said, quote, "It was not an order from above, but that's how it was understood in the field. The infantry understood they were allowed or indeed expected to destroy the property and the offices." The source said while the extent of the damage was clear, the army had yet to undertake a serious investigation. Israeli officials and intelligence sources say the director of the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, is under pressure to leave the agency because he's openly challenged Ariel Sharon. Spy chief Ephraim Halevi opposed Sharon's decision to place Yasser Arafat under house arrest in December, arguing it would only boost his popularity among Palestinians. He also opposed Sharon's plan to exile Arafat. Here at home, Senate Appropriations Chair Robert Byrd says the Bush administration is preventing the public from gaining an overview of the anti-terrorism strategy by barring Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge from testifying to Congress. Byrd's been asking Ridge to testify for months. Administration officials say he has no obligation to testify since he's a presidential advisor who is not confirmed by the Senate. A federal judge in Manhattan has ruled the government may not use a law that allows detention of material witnesses to hold people for grand jury investigations. Judge Shira Shinlin also dismissed perjury charges against a Jordanian student, Osama Owadala, concluding that the information the government collected in its investigation must be suppressed because the suspect had been unlawfully detained. She wrote, quote, "Since 1789, no Congress has granted the government the authority to imprison an innocent person in order to guarantee he will testify before a grand jury conducting a criminal investigation." Legal experts predict the ruling could have far-reaching implications because the material witness statute has emerged as a key tool in the government's post-September 11th detentions. Meanwhile, U.S. federal agents arrested the Syrian-born head of an international Muslim charity at his home in Chicago on Tuesday. Federal authorities charged that Enam Arnot, executive director of the Benevolence International Foundation, lied under oath about his foundation's support for al-Qaeda and other militant groups. And Attorney General John Ashcroft announced murder charges yesterday against six members of the FARC in Colombia in connection with the slaying of the three Americans working with the UA in 1999. Ashcroft said the indictments against the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia demonstrates the Bush administration's determination to prosecute terrorists outside the Muslim world. The charges in the three-year-old case come as the White House is seeking congressional support that will allow U.S. military aid to Colombia to be used directly against the FARC. The Americans who are in Colombia to aid the native UA tribe in its struggle against Occidental Petroleum were Ingrid Washnawatuk, Terence Freitas, and Lahaina Gay. The father and girlfriend of Terence Freitas released a statement accusing the administration of exploiting his killing to, quote, justify further U.S. military aid to the Colombian armed forces. The Afghan Islamic Press reports hundreds of U.S.-led soldiers have launched an operation against suspected Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters in the Mazai Mountains in eastern Afghanistan's Paktia province. The report follows a story in today's Washington Post that the U.S. is moving parts of more than two battalions of the 101st Airborne Division to the Afghanistan-Pakistan border in a strong sign that a major battle is brewing. A respected human rights group and opponents of Pakistani military ruler Pervez Musharraf say widespread abuses and a very low turnout marred Tuesday's referendum to extend his rule for 5 years. Partial returns today on a state-run news agency say the general who took power in a coup in 1999 had captured more than 95% of the vote in the referendum, which circumvented the electoral process. A delegation of foreign and local media is gathering outside the home of Burmese human rights leader Aung San Suu Kyi in anticipation of an end to her house arrest. A government source told the Agence France-Presse Tuesday that arrangements are being made for the Nobel Peace Laureate to be freed, quote, within a day or two. Since September 2000, the street that runs past the democracy leader's home, normally a busy thoroughfare, has been closed off to traffic and barbed wire barricades. But in recent days, municipal crews have patched up potholes, swept away rubbish and leaves, and security officials outside the house said today they've been told to be ready to lay on a motorcade for the pro-democracy leader should she call for transport. Aung San Suu Kyi began secret talks with a military junta in October of 2000.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me, says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
It's May Day. You're listening to Democracy Now!
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all, till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be.
Working class hero. by John Lennon, sung by Marianne Faithfull, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is May Day, the day that honors the struggle of working people throughout the world. From France to Japan, China to Nicaragua, workers are celebrating the occasion with strikes, rallies, marches, and teach-ins. Only the United States, Canada, and South Africa do not recognize the day, though I understand South Africa does, and we'll talk about that with Father Michael Lapsley in a minute. Ironically, it's in the United States that May Day, a pagan first rite of spring holy day celebrating the first spring planting, was first declared International Workers' Day. It came out of the movement for an eight-hour workday that rocked the country more than 100 years ago. On May 1, 1886, the American Federation of Labor called a national strike to put an end to the 12, 14, and even 16-hour days that were common. 2 days into the massive strike, the police opened fire on a crowd of protesters in Chicago, killing four. This set in motion a chain of events that ended the following day with a bomb being thrown at police officers as they descended on peaceful protesters in Haymarket Square. The bomb killed one police officer, injured many more. The police, in turn, fired into the crowd, killing at least one and wounding dozens. Although it was never known who threw that bomb in Haymarket Square, the incident was used as an excuse to attack the left and the labor movement. Eight of Chicago's most active labor leaders were sentenced to death by a kangaroo court, and four of them were ultimately hanged. News of these executions sparked labor protests throughout the world, and in 1889, the Socialist International declared May 1st a day of demonstrations. In cities across the world, activists celebrate International Workers' Day by combining it with protests against racism, militarism, and capitalism. In central Athens, where thousands of demonstrators gathered today, banners read, "Long live international solidarity to Palestine." In Australia, police arrested dozens of people after scuffles broke out at a picket to protest the country's immigration policies. Today in Berlin, thousands gathered at a peaceful May Day and anti-Nazi demonstration. Violence broke out when hundreds of riot police moved in using water cannons against protesters. We're going to go to three May Day demonstrations. In Paris, May Day is a national workers' holiday, and hundreds of thousands have taken to the streets to protest the far-right presidential contender Jean-Marie Le Pen. We go now to Nick Champé, who is a reporter for Radio France International, in the streets of Paris outside today at a pro-Le Pen rally. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nick Champé.
Thank you.
Tell us what's happening.
Well, this morning, since a couple of years, the National Front of people organized a demonstration to celebrate the French medieval heroine, Joan of Arc, who resisted the British during a war that we call the Guerre de Cent Ans in the Middle Ages. Now Le Pen is recuperating the symbol. This celebration normally takes place on May the 12th, but Le Pen now wants to please the working class electorate and organizes a demonstration on the 1st. He was hoping 100,000 people would join the march. In fact, according to police estimates, only 15,000 people attended. Now, the Agence France-Presse said it was there were many young people. I think it was a rather elderly and male-dominated crowd. What was particularly interesting is that although violence would benefit Jean-Marie Le Pen, who campaigned, whose campaign centered around security and crime, they were very careful to try to control extreme right factions. Because you know that on May the 1st, in 1995, in a similar demonstration, a skinhead drowned and killed an Arabic man called Brahim Bouaram. So the National Front was careful to avoid such tragedies because that would ruin their image. In fact, there were left-wing organizations were actually paying tribute to Brahim Bouaram, just a couple of hundreds of yards away from the National Front route. So it was feared violence could erupt at this stage, although it didn't happen. Another very striking element that I think tells us a lot about the National Front is how this whole National Front demonstration was strictly orchestrated. I mean, everything was really supervised by the National Front Bureau, including what was allowed on slogans and banners. Only three types were allowed: the Le Pen president, the youth with Le Pen, and proud to be French. People who showed up with their own personalized banner had either to go away or hide their banner. And the discipline was striking. People just behave. They marched quietly, waving French flags. As soon as the chief, Jean-Marie Le Pen, speaks, everyone shuts up. They really play by the party rules, and no racist slogans, of course, because this could narrow down his appeal. Of course, when you speak to militants on the side, then they'll you see the true color.
And Nick Champagne, there are also major anti-Le Pen rallies taking place as we speak. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, meeting? Yeah, all over France, especially, ever since the results of the first round of the elections were released on April 21st, students, high school and university students, started to organize spontaneous demonstrations. These have taken place on a daily basis without any major incidents. Then last Saturday, you had the first coordinated, if I may say, demonstration that gathered quite a few left-wing organizations, trade unions, student bodies, and so on. Around 50,000 people showed up. This went happened quite smoothly. There were quite a pretty big demonstration and a kind of a north east southeast axis where Le Pen has scored the most already this morning. I think there were already half a million people.
Well, Nick Champagne, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us from Paris, reporter for Radio France International. As we head now to London, hundreds of cyclists converged on the U.S. Embassy. 6,000 police are there. The statue of Winston Churchill outside the House of Parliament has been boarded up. More than 10,000 people in the streets. Roger Sutton is an organizer of the London May Day March. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Greetings to you too.
Tell us what's happening right now in London.
Well, at the moment, I'm just watching the march go past. It's a mixed march of trade unions, the international communities in London, like Turkish, Kurdish, Latin American, from Asia and so on. And then there's lots of political organisations, and there's a lot of anti-globalisation campaigners.
And the major message today on May Day in London?
The traditional message of international solidarity, but particularly focusing on the effects of international economic globalization and the effects that that's having throughout the world, both the effects it's having in terms of privatization programs and getting rid of public services, which are affecting unions, and deregulations and labor markets, attacks on unions, which our Italian colleagues are fighting at the moment, which we've had for 20 years, but also concerns about the international aspects of the new global order and the threats to peace throughout the world.
Roger Sutton, thanks for joining us from London, organizer of the London May Day March. Here in New York, workers will be marching to demand a general amnesty for all undocumented immigrants, marching in the footsteps of the immigrant workers who struggled for the eight-hour day in 1886. We're joined on the telephone by Hector Figueroa, who's Secretary Treasurer of SEIU, Service Employees International Union Local 32BJ. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Buenos dias. Today is the day that we will be raising the question of the rights of immigrant workers. After September 11, there is being an anti-immigrant sentiment growing in the country, just at the very moment that we felt that legalization was within our reach. So we want to bring attention again to the fact that there are millions of undocumented workers in this country that work very hard, pay taxes, are good citizens, hardworking people, and that they should not be scapegoats of the current anti-terrorist war. They deserve rights like any other person who is working for a living. Today in D.C., there's going to be lobbying around the issue of legalization from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., at which point there's going to be a press conference called by a coalition of labor and community organizations spearheaded by the National Coalition for Amnesty. And following that, there will be a vigil in D.C. at 3 p.m. Here in New York, in Boston, in many other cities in the country, we have decided to march in front of the INS offices. The beginning of the march will be at 4 p.m. Everybody will be gathering at front of 26 Federal Plaza, and then marching on to Battery Park, again to demand amnesty, legalization for immigrant workers. We also plan to have a similar event on May 2nd, tomorrow, in New Jersey, in Trenton, a rally at noontime, and on May 8th, a labor spearheaded effort is going to begin a national campaign for amnesty, that we intend to continue through the summer to demand legalization for immigrant workers. Yesterday, we had over 600 people called by the New York Immigration Coalition for, making sure that immigrants do not become the scapegoats on the current budget cuts, and that services for immigrants in New York City are preserved and expanded.
Hector Figueroa, thank you for joining us. Secretary Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union, Local 32BJ in New York, and in Washington, D.C., Baldemar Velasquez, founder and current president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee.
Baldemar Velasquez of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, and we're in Washington today lobbying Congress for a legalization program for undocumented workers in the United States. We organizing many workers in the Deep South, and many of them are undocumented. And it's their undocumented status that keeps them from defending their labor rights when their wages are stolen, when they're harassed on the job. The retaliation always is deportation or being reported. So employers have an enormous hand over these workers. So we're lobbying Congress for what we call our Freedom Act proposal, which the cornerstone is a registry for a temporary residency leading to permanent residency in the United States with full labor rights. And we have a meeting with the leaders of both the Republicans and Democrats today to push them on this issue. And as far as their concerns are about domestic security, we feel that a nation can't be too secure if it can't govern 8 or 9 million people that doesn't know who they are, where they are, where they work, where they're coming, and where they're going.
Baldemar Velasquez, founder and current president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. It's based in Toledo, Ohio. He's in Washington lobbying today. You are listening to Democracy Now! On this May Day. We'll be back in a minute with Father Michael Lapslate.
They tell me, man, you are brave. And I'm not. Bravery never was my vice. I just didn't feel low enough to be quite as cowardly as some I saw around. But I never tried to push the world out of orbit. I just wrote. So what? I never informed, though. And I laughed at what was too much, poked fun at the bogus, tried to say what I thought loud enough to be heard. But a time will come to remember and burn with shame when we shall have done with dishonesty and plain lies, with those strange times when a man who was simply honest was called brave.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In 1980, 3 months after the release of South African freedom fighter Nelson Mandela, the ruling de Klerk government sent anti-apartheid activist Father Michael Lapslate a parcel containing two magazines. Inside one of them was a highly sophisticated bomb. When Father Lapslate opened the magazine, the explosion brought down ceilings in the house, blew a hole in the floors, and shattered windows. It blew off both of Father Michael Lapslate's hands, destroyed one eye, and burned him severely. Michael Lapslate joined the African National Congress in the mid-70s after being expelled from South Africa for his activism. He served for many years as ANC's chaplain in exile, struggling with the tension between his commitment to pacifism and his commitment to resistance against apartheid. While in the hospital, people tried to prepare Father Lapslate for a life of disability, emphasizing all the things he could no longer do. in a speech a couple years ago. Father Lapsley said, "My friend phoned me in the hospital to say he'd just been visiting Cape Town and heard there were plans to start a center for victims of violence and torture. He told me, 'I think that is a job which you can do. You will be better qualified now.'" Today, Father Michael Lapsley is the director of the Institute for Healing of Memories in South Africa, and he travels the world talking about issues of reconciliation, oppression, and he joins us here at the Firehouse Studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be here on May Day, and I know that it was an old piece of news that said there was no May Day celebration in South Africa. In fact, workers in South Africa declared May Day long before it became a public holiday, which of course it is now. I should also say that, in fact, I was bombed in 1990, not 1980. But nevertheless, it's really great to be here. It seems you get me in every May Day, and so I'm happy to be here.
That's right. You were our May Day guest 2 years ago.
And I suppose for me, it is an incredible irony that it's not a holiday in the United States, and it suggests that the U.S. has a long way to go to catch up with the rest of the human family on this issue and other issues.
One of your compatriots, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, has been speaking about the issue of the occupation. He said, "In our struggle against apartheid, the great supporters were Jewish people. They almost instinctively had to be on the side of the disenfranchised, of the voiceless ones, fighting injustice, oppression, and evil. I have continued to feel strongly with the Jews. I am patron of a Holocaust center in South Africa. I believe Israel has a right to secure borders. What is not so understandable," Desmond Tutu says, "not justified, is what it did to another people to guarantee its existence. I've been very deeply distressed in my visit to the Holy Land. It reminded me so much of what happened to us black people in South Africa. I've seen the humiliation of the Palestinians at checkpoints, roadblocks, suffering like us when young white police officers prevented us from moving about." And he went on to say his heart aches. Your response to this?
I totally agree with Archbishop Tutu. One of our leaders, Chief Lutuli, once said, "Those who think of themselves as victims eventually become the victimizers of others." And perhaps the great tragedy of the Israeli state is that a nation full of people have known such pain, such victimization, go on themselves to be perpetrators. And the point the Archbishop makes that a disproportionate number of Jewish people were part of our struggle for liberation. And in fact, in South Africa today, Minister Ronnie Kasrils, himself a Jewish person of Jewish origin, has led a movement in South Africa, Not in My Name. And this is precisely Jewish people in South Africa who are wanting to dissociate themselves from the actions of the Israeli state and identify with the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinian people. And I think it struck a deep chord in the South African nation when we've heard Palestinians saying to us, "What we are fighting for are the same rights that you as South Africans fought for and have now achieved." So there's a very profound identification. I think many of us also want to make it, refuse to accept the view that if we're pro-Palestinian, that we're anti-Semitic. And I think our Jewish leaders, leading Not in His Name, help us to focus on it. Just as it was incredibly important that there were white people in South Africa who were part of the struggle for liberation. And of course there are young Israelis who are refusing to fight in the occupied territories. And they, I think, themselves are helping guarantee a real future for both Israeli and Palestinian.
You have just come from Australia?
Yes, I've been, was there last week, but also in the month of March, I spent in Alice Springs, right in the center of Australia. It's really like a frontier town between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians. And we were conducting Healing of Memories workshops there, providing opportunities for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to tell one another their stories. You know, the Aboriginal people, for 200 years of colonialism, were denied their most fundamental rights. Of course, Aboriginal society is the most continuous Indigenous society on earth. Their history goes back 40,000 years. But for the first 200 years of colonialism in Australia, the Australian state said that when they came to Australia, there was nobody there. So I think it was only in 1967 the Aboriginal people got the vote. And they are now less than 1% of the population. Aboriginal people, their life expectancy is 20 years less than that of white people, the same place that white Australians were 100 years ago. So there are incredibly deep issues. I think one of the encouraging things, signs of hope in Australia, is the number of white Australians who are beginning to confront their past, beginning to face it. Because I think, as in South Africa, we realize that unless you face the truth of the past, you have no foundations on which to begin a journey towards reconciliation and healing. And it's interesting in your little clip about May Day that there was reference in Australia to protests against asylum seekers. I think if there are two fundamental issues in Australia today, one is the issue of the rights and the situation of Aboriginal people and the journey to national reconciliation. The other is the maltreatment of asylum seekers and the way Australia has been flagrantly disregarding international human rights law in relation to asylum seekers. And of course, it's very important to see and to say that xenophobia is a form of racism.
We're talking to Father Michael Lapsley. He's just come from Australia. He is an Anglican priest in South Africa, where he runs an institute dedicated to the healing of memory, and is now in New York. This week in New York, you're going to be working with family members of those who died on September 11th.
Apart from the joy of being on Democracy Now!, I hadn't intended to be in New York now, but I was invited through the Cathedral of St. John the Divine here in New York City. They told me about an organization called 911 Families for a Peaceful Future, families of those who lost relatives on September the 11th, who are extremely unhappy about the direction of the United States policy. And many of them themselves have been to Kabul to meet families who died in Afghanistan. And it seemed to me that in the face of the extraordinary loud voices calling for hatred and revenge in the U.S., that we need to provide every kind of support to people who don't want to continue the cycle of victims becoming perpetrators. And so these Families for a Peaceful Future, I think, are flickers of light and hope in the United States. And we'll have a seminar at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine on Thursday, this Thursday evening, an interfaith perspective on initiatives for reconciliation that have been taking place since September the 11th. And I'll also be then preaching at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. But of course, common to all this work that I do is this issue of how people as individuals respond to their nation's past. And I think whatever happens to us as individuals or nations, it can either cause us to grow in hope and compassion and kindness, or it can bring out the worst in us. And at the level of the administration, it seems to have brought out the worst in Americans. And yet there are these voices, other kinds of voices of humanity that are being raised that need strengthening and support. And that's what I'm here to do, is to give that kind of support.
Speaking of avenging attacks on innocent civilians by killing innocent civilians, there's a piece in the New York Times today, Study Hints at Mass Killing of the Taliban. And its dateline is Dashti Laili, Afghanistan. It says, a tangle of abandoned clothes half covered in sand lies just off the desert track. Pieces of white bone are strewn among the mess, and the smell of decaying bodies drifts over the site. In a country ravaged by 23 years of war, the war dead lie forgotten in many places of Afghanistan. But this spot in Dashti Laili, a desert that stretches west from the town of Shibargan in northern Afghanistan, hides what are suspected to be large-scale killings committed 5 months ago by Afghan allies of the United States in the war against the Taliban. And it talks about the calling for urgent measures of Physicians for Human Rights that would investigate this site.
I met yesterday a very beautiful African-American woman, Imani, whose relative died on September the 11th, and she said that she was invited to participate in grief sessions after September the 11th, and she said she went three times and then stopped because she found it wasn't about grief, it was about hatred and revenge. And she said the person, her relative who died, didn't stand for that. She stood for life-giving values, and she said when the bombing began of Afghanistan, she cried and cried and cried because, you know, her own values were not about the cycle of hatred and revenge, but precisely about how do we break that cycle as human beings.
May 4th is coming up. It's the anniversary of the Kent State killings, and one of the family members of a person who died at the World Trade Center, Rita Lazar, who we've had on a few times, who will travel to Afghanistan to bridge the sorrow, is going to be speaking at Kent State on May 4th. But you have been traveling the world since you have healed from your own attack, from the attack on you by the apartheid regime, the letter bomb that blew off your hands and eye. Talking about the healing of memory, how do you do that?
Well, it's a deep and long and difficult process, but I think the first thing is that we have to have the space to acknowledge the deep feelings we have within us. And sometimes when something terrible has happened, it's natural and normal in a way to be full of hatred, to be bitter, to want revenge. And I think in the face of having one's pain acknowledged, often we can begin the process of letting that go and realizing that if we are filled with hatred and bitterness, we are no different from those who have done these things to us. You see, we either travel on a journey from being victims to victimizers, like the Israeli state or like the United States itself, or we travel a different kind of journey from being victims to victors, and that is traveling through a journey of getting the poison out from within us, seeing that that poison can destroy us, and being part of creating a different kind of world, being part of committing ourselves to a world of restorative justice, for example, rather than retributive justice.
What do you mean, restorative justice?
Well, I know that many people in the United States can't spell the word restorative justice. Restorative justice, I suppose it's... let me give you an example. If somebody said to me, I sent you this letter bomb, I'm sorry, please will you forgive me? I would say to that person, well, do you still make letter bombs? And they might say, well, actually, I work in a local hospital. And I would want to say to that person, I prefer you spend the next 50 years working in that local hospital rather than locked up in prison, because that would be an example of restorative justice rather than retributive justice. Rather than the justice of punishment, it's the justice of restoring relationships that can still involve sanction, but it involves a making up to society rather than the kind of punishment which I suppose most dramatically is illustrated in the U.S. by the death penalty. And I suppose that's part of the example that didn't help the U.S. when it was confronted by the terrible things that did happen on September the 11th. It harked back to these voices of revenge which don't free us. They in fact become a pathology within the nation, which of course is why it was significant in South Africa that we, suppose we had three possibilities in the face of what happened to us as a nation. We could either go down the route of hatred and revenge, or we could try to bury and forget. But instead we said as a nation, we want to remember and to heal. And that seems to me the only kind of life-giving way forward for a nation and indeed for the human family.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings are all over. In fact, recently, and then there's the actual trials, the criminal trials of people like the doctor in South Africa who is accused of experimenting on South Africans. He ultimately was acquitted, but...
Well, the unfortunately, our legal system wasn't able to find him guilty, but neither did it find him innocent. And I think most of the nation is pretty clear that, in fact, he was guilty. But the problem is,
case for a brief moment.
Well, Dr. Passon was involved in chemical and biological warfare. He was the chemical and biological warfare expert for the apartheid state. And there was a very lengthy trial. Part of the problem is that we haven't yet transformed our judiciary. And it was an old order judge who, in the face of hundreds of witnesses, chose to believe the defendant. But I suppose you have to put that beside this process of amnesty, which we did have, and people like Dr. Passon didn't take that route. And so they were open. The trial is still, in fact, on appeal, and we'll still see what happens. But, of course, there were people further up the chain of command that probably take heavier responsibility than Dr. Passon. And lower down the chain of command, those who voted for that kind of society. So we are still on a very long road as a nation. I think we still have giant problems and challenges. I think we'll spend the next 100 years struggling to create a different kind of society and dealing with our future, dealing with our past at the same time.
And in your case, the people responsible specifically for the letter bomb?
Nobody came forward to the Truth Commission. I don't know who actually was responsible. And like, I suppose, like any person who was victimized, I have a need to know, but it's not a pathological need to know. I'm not obsessed by it. I realize that if I spent my life chasing those who did it to me, that would consume me and control me. I'm interested to know, but I'm much more committed to being part of the healing journey of nations. I suppose when I was bombed, people of goodwill, faith, and hope around the world gave me support, and that enabled me to travel the journey from victim to victor. And I'm seeking to return the compliment by walking beside other peoples around the world so that they too can be freed from victimhood. I should just say around our Truth Commission that while it had giant achievements of laying bare the truth, we still have major unfinished business there. The state hasn't yet come up with the process of reparations for those who were declared victims, and that, so that's part of our unfinished business as a Truth Commission. And there's a giant debate in South Africa about the importance of reparations and not just acknowledgement, which of course rings many bells, I think, for many people in the United States, where reparations is also on the agenda, particularly for in relation to slavery.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Father Michael Lapsley. If people want to get in touch with your institute, the Institute for the Healing of Memory, where can they go on the web?
Well, there's at www.healingofmemories.co.za. Healingofmemories.co.za. And we'd welcome...
That's co.za.
Oh, Z-A. I don't speak American. I'm sorry.
And if people want to go to our website, you'll find all that information at www.democracynow.org.
And the New Yorkers will all be with us tomorrow night at St. John the Divine at 7 o'clock.
And we thank you very much for being with us and hope to see you again even earlier than next May Day.
Thanks very much.
Actually, I think I'll be seeing you next week.
Yes, we'll be together at the Independence of Timor-Leste. And I guess in the midst of all this darkness, that's a giant sign of hope in the world that a nation that lost a third of its people during Indonesian occupation is becoming independent. I think every person of goodwill needs to wish the Timorese well. And it's great in terms of your contribution as well to the struggle of the Timorese people that you'll be there. It'll be a very wonderful occasion.
So, folks, tune in the coming weeks from the 13th to the 24th. Democracy Now! Will be in East Timor and on Sunday as well, which is the day at midnight that East Timor will become an independent nation. Father Michael Lapsley, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the second part of our conversation with anti-corporate globalization activist Maud Barlow on Blue Gold Water. Stay with us.
Thought, if you control nature, remember how water seems pent in and trapped till the dam breaks and crumbles and dies like its maker. To blockade life's plan is cruel, fatal, blind, deadly to those that imprison the force to be free, unquote. From John Africa, the Judge's Letter. Summer 1993 is an awesome spectacle of the raw power of Mother Nature. An earthquake near the northern Japanese islands of Hokkaido and Honshu kills hundreds while devastating property over a wide region. Heavy rains swell the mighty Mississippi River until it bursts its banks, flooding seven Midwestern states, virtually inundating one state. While floods ravage the Midwest, southern states experience drought. A heat wave of at least 100 degree temperatures melts the East Coast, leaving hundreds dead and/or debilitated. In Philadelphia alone, almost 100 people died in 1 week from baking temperatures.
Waterfall, Steve Cole, Lisa Lopez's song. She died over the weekend in Honduras, mixed with It's Not Nice to Fool with Mother Nature, Mumia Abu-Jamal. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we turn to part two of our conversation with Maud Barlow, talking about the issue of water. The wars of the next century will be about water, she quotes. Her new book with Tony Clark is called Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water. I started by asking her how extensive the threat to the world's water supply is.
Well, basically, the amount of fresh water that we have is absolutely finite and being polluted, diverted, and depleted so fast that everyone agrees who's looked at this. The United Nations, the World Bank, the World Watch Institute, everyone says that by the year 2025, almost two-thirds of the world's population will be living without access to clean water. As it is now, we have polluted vast amounts of the world's surface water. Almost every 8 seconds a child dies of some form of waterborne disease. I mean, and already it's very much here in the third world. And now we're moving to take the underground sources at an alarming rate, far faster than nature can replenish them. So in fact, we're facing an immediate water crisis of pollution and scarcity in some parts of the world, and a looming problem of water scarcity everywhere.
You talk about water scarcity, but how can people live without water? I mean, when you say, well, in 20 years and 30 years, I mean, how could it be?
You can't. The reality is that we know that water is necessary for all life. It's irreplaceable. There is no technological way to make more of it. And by the way, desalination is not the answer. It's very expensive. It's highly polluting, and it's very fossil fuel intensive, which is part of the problem.
What do you mean it's very polluting?
Because you have to take the salt out of it, essentially, and the salt concentrates. That is the byproduct of it, has to go somewhere. It goes back into the ocean and it pollutes wherever it's put back in. And it also uses an enormous amount of fossil fuels, which is part of the problem. I mean, the global warming and water scarcity are part and parcel of the same problem through drought and through dams and through the destruction of fresh waters, natural places in nature.
It's interesting in your book, and I never thought about it this way, the more you urbanize the
yes.
world, the more there is water depletion. Can you explain that?
That's the scariest study, which is published for the first time in this book, that I have seen on water. And this was done by a group of scientists in Slovakia who are actually able to show that for every percentage of urbanization, the actual amount of water in the hydrologic cycle is diminished. Fresh water turns to salt water because water that evaporates doesn't come back to meadows and lakes and streams and wetlands. It falls onto pavement. It's like falling onto a cement umbrella that falls into the ocean. So what's happening is that with urbanization, we're forcing rain to move back into the oceans and convert to salt water. And they claim that one of the most powerful rights of all is the right of a drop of water to domicile, is what they call it, to come back where it belongs, which just blew me away as a concept. So the thing is, Amy, as we're beginning to understand this, it's a terrible thing that the main ideology, if you will, of the entire world are the principles of the Washington Consensus: privatization, deregulation, governments, you know, allowing institutions like the World Bank or the World Trade Organization to establish the rules. So what's happening is that there's a massive grab to take this to take up water because, as you say, we can't live without it. Well, some people will be able to buy the best water in the world in the future. Already, in fact, that's the case, and some people will die. We say that there are many, many ways that we can approach how to save the world's water. We know actually physically, environmentally, how that can be done through changes from corporate farming to sustainable farming, from flood irrigation to drip irrigation to capturing the water that's being lost in infrastructure to reclamation to strict legislation around chemicals and toxics. Like, we know how to save the world's water. And of course, very strict laws around industrial destruction of our water. But there's no political will because there's this notion of abundance and there's notion that somehow you'll just be able to go buy it or bring it in from somewhere else. So there are now those who are talking about massive movements of water, for instance, from Canada to California or from parts
that Canada will become a water exporter.
Absolutely, just the way we are with our natural gas. We own very little of our natural gas. Under the North American Free Trade Agreement, we signed a proportional sharing agreement, and now we owe most of our natural gas that we produce to the United States. We would be locked into that exact same regime under NAFTA if we started exporting water to the U.S. So we're talking about this notion that we have that either some parts of the world don't matter, it doesn't matter if those people die, or other wealthy parts that are destroying their water will just be able to ship it in from somewhere else, or somehow technology will take care of it. Well, the reality is there isn't that the amount of water in the world is too small to be allowed to continue the destruction of it.
Maude Barlow, what is a hot stain?
A hot stain are the parts of the world that are already in water crisis, where there's a dispute already happening. Either the Middle East, China, which is massively converting its use of water to promote its, quote, economic miracle. Half of China's population now does not have adequate access to fresh water. 22 countries in Africa are in severe crisis. Mexico, much of Latin America.
You mentioned Mexico. The U.S.-Mexico border, where the maquiladoras are, what about that area?
Well, it's just pure poison. I mean, that's a double case of water scarcity and total pollution. The amount of pesticides and nitrates and so on that have been put into the system along that, what they call the 3,400-mile Love Canal, has tripled since NAFTA came into effect. I mean, we just have companies going there and dumping their effluents. I remember my first trip to the maquiladoras. Somebody took me into this, it was Tijuana, into a tributary that runs into the Tijuana River, and I took a pencil and dipped it into this water, and the pencil came out stripped of its paint. So, I mean, I remember very vividly, and that was 10 years ago, before it was as bad as it is now.
What about the idea of water shortages breaking down borders because of how water flows?
Well, that there are disputes. Many of the world's river systems now, of course, are shared between countries. And what we're calling for is that the people of the world, through their governments or another institution, it may be something new that has to come together, will declare water to be a public asset. Actually, we say, and the most important thing you can ask about water is who owns it, because all things come from that answer. The corporations at the World Trade Organization, at the World Bank, at this new World Water Council, which is this new big water institution, they all say the future of water is a private future. It's going to be commodified. It's going to be privatized. It's going to be put on the open market for sale to the highest bidder. We say, no, it's not. It belongs, in fact, to the earth. It belongs to all species, and it belongs to future generations, and we must all take action now to keep water as a fundamental human right and to keep it as part of the public commons. And that's the fight. We're not going to save water till we have that fight, if you will. That's the first fight, is naming water as part of our common heritage.
There was an international summit on water called the World Water Forum at The Hague. What was this about? Who ran it?
Okay, this very important group, the World Water Council, it's the United Nations, the World Bank, and big companies like Vivendi and Suez and Nestle and all the big water companies. And they came together to form this big council, so-called confront the world water crisis. Their first major international forum was in March 2000 in The Hague, and they brought together 5,500 people from around the world. But they ran it as a training ground for the private companies. It was an appalling event. And there were a number of us there who formed what we called the Blue Planet Project, which are groups from around the world, peasants' movements, public sector workers in South Africa, and so on. And we gave them enormous, no end of trouble. We held a press conference every day. We said, this is disgraceful. The big companies have taken over this process. They've decided that we all agree on a privatized future for water, and we do not all agree. We interrupted their meetings. We took over the co-chaired some of the meetings from the floor. And we made such an impact that with the next one, which is coming up in Kyoto, Japan, in March 2003, already we're being told you have a central place in this debate, and we're going in, we're organizing. We organized in Porto Alegre, Brazil, when we were there for the Second World Water Forum in January. We're going to be organizing further through the World Summit on Sustainable Development, Rio+10, this fall in Johannesburg, where, by the way, the World Bank, the WTO, is trying to get the UN to adopt the Doha ministerial text from Doha, Qatar, as the framework document for these environmental talks.
You were in Qatar.
I was in Qatar. And what I saw in Qatar made me sick. And by the way, water was central to what they were trying to do there. They put in a clause at the last moment on breaking down tariff and non-tariff barriers to environmental services, which is water. And it was Europe that put those in for
this
their big companies.
This was at the meeting of the World Trade Organization,
yeah, in,
kept away
Qatar.
From everyone.
So now they want to take that ministerial document, which is basically a mantra to huge free trade, unregulated markets, more investment, you know, the the whole story, and they want that to be the blueprint for Rio Plus 10 in Johannesburg. And they're now using a term, Amy, and you're going to hear lots of this, called convergence. And convergence means that everything submits itself to that framework. Washington Consensus model, the principles of free trade, market growth, open investment, this is the answer for development. This is the answer to the world's poor. This is the answer to the environment. There's going to be a huge fight in Johannesburg on the part of those of us who deeply and profoundly disagree with them. And from the water perspective, we'll take that into Kyoto in March 2003, where we will challenge the water vision, the world water vision that came out of The Hague, because it was based on a private future for water. So right now, what you're seeing, and it hasn't been very public yet, and certainly even in our movement it's not public, the growth of a new international civil society movement, social movement, to reclaim water back into the public hands as a necessary precondition to saving the world's water.
We're talking to Maud Barlow. Her book is Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water. She wrote it with Tony Clark of the Council of Canadians, well-known anti-corporate globalization activists at almost every one of the protests of the large international financial institutions, from Qatar to Genoa to the World Trade Organization meeting back in Seattle in 1999. We talked on Tuesday about Vivendi and Suez, the largest water companies. Nestle, Pepsi-Cola, Coca-Cola, where do they fit in?
Well, these big bottled water companies they're scouring the world for water. These companies know that the most precious thing of all and something they can make enormous amounts of money in is bottled water. Next will be the mass movement of water, and we're already beginning to see that. And you may not know, but Alaska was the first jurisdiction in the world to promote, to pass a law allowing the commercial sale of bulk export of water. So this is already beginning, and it's beginning in other parts of the world, but this is the first jurisdiction that actually passed a law to do so. So the next move of this is more massive bottling of water and the beginning of the discussion of how to move massive water shipments either by tanker or by pipeline or whatever. These bottled water companies are scouring the world's places where there's still fresh water. Boutique water will sell for just about anything in New York or London or Tokyo, the places where people have the money to buy really good water. It competes with each other. It's a bunch of nonsense, of course. Water's water. But, you know, they'll convince you that their water is better. In fact, studies show that much of bottled water is no better than tap water, if the public system is a good public system, such as here in New York, or if sometimes it's even worse, that they've taken water and they haven't done anything with it except slap a pretty label on it. Sometimes spring water isn't necessarily better because you don't know what factory or farm that it's nearby. So just because it's spring water doesn't mean it's clean. So the fight against privatizing water is now heating up in California, it's heating up in Florida, it's heating up in New Mexico, where they've had a traditional system of trading water, and now that the move is to grab that water and keep it in private hands for sale.
And that is Maud Barlow, as we cut short that conversation. She is author of Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water. She stopped by in our Firehouse studio yesterday to talk about the next century. The wars will be about water. And you are listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to go to our website, you can get all contact information at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. You can also email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Tomorrow, Juan Gonzalez will be back with us as co-host of Democracy Now! And we thank you for listening on this May Day. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
And there was day and there was night, and there was dark and there was light, and there was the earth, there was the sky, and there there in the tree they crawled alive. There in need and there was good. There in the garden where the tree of life stood. There the snake was, there was pain. And we're trying to get back to the garden again. Talking, there was shame.